work is intensifying in the Middle East to broker a truce in the fighting, a truce at least and a ceasefire at best. Today, the number of Palestinians killed has reached more than 732 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have died in the last 2 weeks. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has been meeting the main players since he arrived in the region on Monday. Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, is on the line now from London. The Egyptians say rather optimistically that there will be a truce in place by the weekend. Shashank, what's your view?
Well, there's a distinction between a truce, a humanitarian truce, which Hamas says it's open to, and a ceasefire per se, which would bring the conflict to an end, which Hamas says it won't accept until at least some of its conditions are met, above all the opening of Gaza border crossings to allow goods and equipment to move in and out. And that doesn't look like it's on the cards just yet. Egypt, of course, it has to be remembered, under its new government, its new military-backed government, is very much against Hamas, and therefore it's not amenable to doing anything that would help Hamas out while it's being put under so much pressure by Israel.
Given the suffering that we've seen the Palestinian people going through in over the last 2 weeks, and indeed over the last number of years, how long can Hamas hold out in the face of that and also the ever-diminishing resources that they must be dealing with?
That's certainly true. For the last year, of course, don't forget that their supply networks, those underground tunnels that connect Gaza to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, have been systematically destroyed and targeted by the Egyptians. You know, it's Cairo that imposes a blockade on Gaza as much as Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. How long can they stand out? Well, their rocket stockpiles may be depleted. You know, they started with perhaps 10,000. That's probably gone down to below half of that, and it's difficult to replenish the better ones. They can make some of the middle-range ones inside Gaza. But I think there's a distinction between their military strength, which has been severely damaged, particularly their internal tunnels within Gaza, the ones they use to move stuff within Gaza and to attack Israel, not the Egyptian ones. There's a distinction between that and their political strength, which doesn't appear to have been damaged much at all. And the more that Israel has struck them, there appears to be no corresponding effect on how Gazans view Hamas. I think it's always difficult to judge, of course, because Hamas is an autocratic political entity. It doesn't allow dissent, and it punishes dissent. So it's very hard to gauge its popular support.
And then from the Israeli point of view, it seems from what they have done and what they have said over the last number of days that they have a job to do, closing off the tunnels, and that Israel won't stop until that job is done. Do you agree?
Well, no, I don't agree entirely, of course. This is an elastic aim. The initial aim of the operation was to restore deterrence. That was initially about rocket supplies and damaging those. And now it's become about tunnels. And there's no particular reason that tunnels were prominent at the beginning of this conflict. They've simply become very prominent because, in part, they were used last week for a couple of attacks. But there are simply too many tunnels. You know, the IDF doesn't have the intelligence across Gaza to know how many there are, exactly where the entrances are, where they go. So they can destroy them, but they can't destroy all of them. That would just require a complete reoccupation of Gaza, because many of the entrances are within civilian houses, are within civilian areas. So only a full-scale occupation could address that problem. Israel doesn't have the stomach for that, in my opinion. And so this conflict will end without a complete dismantlement of Hamas's military. That's a fact. That simply is what's going to happen. The only question is how much does Israel have to destroy before it can come away claiming victory? And if Hamas refuses to accept a ceasefire to the status quo and demands a lifting of the blockade, well, Israel isn't going to sit back and just accept the rockets, even if it pulls out. So you're going to have to see someone move on this.
So there will have to be, if there's a benefit for Hamas in any negotiated ceasefire, there's got to be a reciprocal benefit for Israel. So what could be offered, do you think?
Well, from Hamas's point of view, the benefit would be we'll stop firing rockets, of course. but I think, you know, does Hamas in some way look at a ceasefire as a kind of favour to Israel, rightly or wrongly? But what else can they offer? Well, don't forget the ceasefire that was signed in 2012, brokered by Egypt, that bought a couple of years of peace. Hamas actually did implement that ceasefire. It stopped other groups within Gaza, like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, from firing rockets. Now, that did break down a couple of times, of course, you know, in the summer of 2013. But on the whole, Hamas did guarantee a level of peace and stability for Israel, a freedom from rocket fire that you wouldn't have dreamed of 5 years before that, in 2006, 2007. So that's what Hamas can offer. They can offer peace, essentially.
And I see from a piece that you wrote 2 days ago that you criticised America for not getting involved quickly enough. But do you think that John Kerry is the right person to mediate this ceasefire if it does happen?
Well, look, he's the only real person. It's a shame that his standing in the region is so low amongst Egyptians, amongst Israelis, because of the failed peace process earlier this year, and amongst so many other people. And, you know, he does have a habit of putting his foot in it. But he's the only person who has that stature, along with Ban Ki-moon, to bring the mediators together. Because don't forget, the mediators themselves are at each other's throats. You have Qatar and Turkey pro-Hamas, you have Egypt anti-Hamas, and you need someone who can oversee these disputes, even amongst those who are supposed to be solving the fundamentals dispute. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't just blame Kerry, I blame everyone. Look at Turkey. You know, Prime Minister Erdogan said that Israel was committing systematic genocide and compared it to Hitler. And by saying that, he of course excluded himself from any meaningful role. So mediators have to be more mature and long-sighted about these things and act much quicker before we have mass invasions of small, densely packed urban areas.
And do you expect that we'll see a humanitarian truce before we get to the ceasefire point?
Yeah, I think that's going to have to be a stepping stone. I think that's going to have to be a step, because Hamas won't stop, won't give a ceasefire, but what they might be able to do is give a humanitarian truce and say, we're not defeated, we're not stopping, this is for the people of Gaza. They might be able to sell that quite effectively. And in that time, we can use that time to then intensively talk between Hamas and the Israelis in somewhere like Cairo or Doha. And that time is sorely needed, because right now, we've all seen the awful statistics on the number of people dying, number of children dying every hour in Gaza. And so any truce that could buy time for talks is sorely needed at this point.
What do you make of the UN intervention in all of this and the mention of potentially investigating Israel for war crimes? Is that useful or not?
Well, my own opinion is that no state should be above the law. That includes established members of the international community, like Israel, but of course also European states and North American countries. But in practical terms, it probably won't help. Israel will judge it to be a case of the world pointing at it exceptionally over and above other states committing similar crimes. They'll say, well, the people pointing to us never pointed to Assad with as much vigor, and he has committed crimes on a far greater scale. So in that sense, I think people have to be more even-handed about how they point the war crime stick. But of course, if violations have been committed, it's imperative that both sides then are investigated in some fashion, because no army anywhere, and that includes the US and UK in Iraq or Afghanistan, should be above impunity.
Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, thank you for joining us on the line from London.